This is Take Flight with Mark Whittle.
Welcome to Take Flight. I'm Mark Whittle, former city worker turned performance coach. And this is your place for inspiration and education on ways to optimize your performance and find your purpose.
We negotiated an amazing deal with OF, you know, talking like seven-figure deals.
It just feels like you've got some incredibly exciting things on the horizon.
When I did the OF TV deal, it was such a big deal. But because I took on this new role where I'm a co-creator and executive producer of the show, it's new territory for me. I come from like fairly humble beginnings and I went to a normal school. I didn't really have any GCSEs. I didn't go to college. I didn't go to university. And there I left, went into The Only Way Is Essex at like 21. Big shout out to Joey and Chloe who got me in the show. I had a real roller coaster ride. When we were put together, you know, we weren't really friends. Like no one really knew each other. I made the decision to leave the show, to leave my girlfriend at the time. And I actually stopped talking to Chloe. We just completely cut contact. We need to find some sort of balance. And I think we need to understand what we're actually working for. You need to figure out who people are, who you are. You need to just be authentic to yourself.
Charlie, welcome to the Take Flight podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for having me. You've got such an incredible home here. I know you said you've only been here 3 months, but it's amazing. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we moved in like 3 months ago. We've been renovating it, so you're one of the first people to come round.
Oh, pleasure, honour. Mate, I've been really looking forward to speaking because, well, I think the first time that we spoke was after the Connor episode, but I've been obviously aware of the things that you've done for such a long time. Admired what you've done, even to the point where like I remember you doing the coffee shop like a long time ago. So yeah, being aware of what you've done and it's a real pleasure to be here. So looking forward to hearing all about the story.
Yeah, let's go as deep as you want, Mark. You already rolled back a few years, so we might as well go for it.
Well, before we go back, because there's so many interesting things that have happened in the past, including like TV and then business and even things like with your dad and stuff, is such a fascinating story. But I think like what excites me the most is it feels like it's almost like a time when you're on the crest of a wave a little bit here. Like with what you're doing with the athletes and stuff. And we'll talk more about it, but there's Conor Benn who was on the podcast recently and the Eubank fight, which is happening, which you were a part of obviously making happen and everything with the OnlyFans TV docuseries, which has been announced like a few weeks ago, whatever it is. So it just feels like you've got some incredibly exciting things on the horizon.
Yeah, I mean, it seems odd because like you keep working and chipping away and I feel like I've been doing it a long time, trying to find my feet, trying to figure out what I'm going to do next, especially after I left the show. I was kind of left with a fresh slate moment and it was kind of like you need to choose what you want to do and figure out what you want to do with life. And I went down the sports route, which we'll go into more detail, and then got more into the influencer side, started looking after my sisters, like managing them, which is quite interesting, family dynamic. And then OFTV, we did a deal with them, struck a big deal. And yeah, like you said, it's been a crazy few months. It seems like everything I've worked for has come together in like the last few months. But also I think what's been the most interesting part, apart from closing the deals, is trying to figure out how you continue performing at this sort of level. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's been the most interesting thing for me. Yeah. So,
because it's like it's a feeling, isn't it? Like you reach a certain height and then there's a hunger to feel more of that or even higher than that.
I mean, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine recently and I kind of said to him, I feel like I've overachieved like already, you know, like I come from like fairly humble beginnings and I went to a normal school. I didn't really have any GCSEs. I didn't go to college. I didn't go to university. I just went straight into working at 16 and trying to find my feet and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And then most people know me from going into the show. But before that, I was a bond broker and I did an apprenticeship from 17 to about 21. And that for me was like the first real insight to how life was going to be. And that was a tough environment. I was surrounded by 1,000 men on the floor and there was a lot of banter and there was a lot of stick back then, stuff you can't say anymore. And they were living the high life. And that was the first real taste for me. That was like, okay, I want to start driving nice cars and having nice houses and wearing nice suits and shoes and being able to go out to any restaurant I want to go to in London. That was kind of like, for me, first insight into the big wide world. And then from there, I left, went into The Only Way Is Essex at like 21. Had a real roller coaster ride because I was working with people that ultimately had different goals and different aspirations, and we were put together. You know, we weren't really friends. Like, no one really knew each other. Like, I knew a few. Like, I had a few family members on it. Like, Joey Essex is my cousin, and Chloe is my older sister. So, I was with them mainly. But the other people in there, I didn't really know them, and hadn't even really heard of most of the people, to be honest. Like, some of the people that were on there, they kind of knew from the area, but I didn't know anybody. So I was kind of thrown into that environment. And again, I had to like adapt and try and figure out how I was going to play this and how I was going to try and make the show work for me, which again, we'll touch on at some point, but it all ended quite sourly and I decided to leave. And then from that moment onwards, it was like, right, well, what do you do now? Like, you know, so went into the sports stuff, got involved in that in an era where it wasn't really big, like boxing in particularly. That's my main sport, and it wasn't really big back then. People didn't really have agents. They had boxing managers, but the managers were usually trainers, and they were kind of like just trying to guide people into fights. But no one really knew about contractual negotiations and like commercial profiles and sponsorship and endorsement deals. Like, that just didn't exist in boxing. It weren't that sort of sport. So I came around at a time where that started to pick up, and Eddie Hearn kind of brought Sexy back to boxing. And, you know, it kind of, AJ was just part of this like new era, and we just see the end of Groves Froch 2 at Wembley Stadium. So I was getting involved in a sexy sport. And that kind of just grew from there until we got to this point today. So yeah, it's just crazy like wave that you mentioned earlier, but it's been an interesting ride.
Wild, wild ride, mate. But you're only 30 as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mate, incredible. And I just want to say congrats for everything that you've done, because it is inspiring.
Thank you.
And I've admired that from a distance. Boxing has just got better and better, hasn't it? Like, I'm a former footballer and that was my sport, but I find myself watching more boxing now than ever.
Boxing's so exciting, like, as a sport anyway. It's a bit tough because, like, the networks, especially, like, the mainstream networks, like BBC, ITV, Channel 4. Channel 5 have dipped their toe in, ITV have dipped their toe in, but let's just say like BBC and networks like that haven't really gone into boxing, and it's because it's a blood sport and they just don't want it to, you know, they just don't feel like it's going to connect to the general public.
Yeah.
But I mean, the diehard fans and people like me and you who love sports anyway, we're just seeing the best events. And I think especially now in this moment in time where you've got Sky Sports, BT Sports, DAZN, Triller, and then you've got the stateside, ESPN, HBO still involved, Fox, them sort of, you know, platforms. We're starting to see the best fights come together. And man, it's just what a time to be alive in boxing.
I went to Bournemouth, the Isaac Chamberlain, Chris Billen Smith fight the other week. Even those ones that are like, I don't want to speak down on that event because it was incredible, but the smaller scale events, what a great fight that was in that weight class. And like, just, they're just so fun, man. But it's like, sometimes you're wincing. It's like, oh, you're watching two people literally beat the shit out of each other. But just as far as a sport, like, I just think, like you said, the best fights are being made. It's so exciting. And
yeah, it's interesting because like, I feel emotionless like when I'm watching the fights. Mm. Like, I feel like I've just adapted that behavior because one, I've always been around boxing. Like, my dad's been a boxing trainer, you know, since the day I could probably walk. So I've walked around in boxing gyms from a real young age, and I know what you have to go through, and I know what I have to do in sparring. I've watched people really hit the highs and really hit the lows. So the problem is now when I'm watching fights that I'm not emotionally connected to, I'm almost emotionless, and I'm just trying to enjoy the fight now, like as a fan, rather than trying to understand, you know, where this fight has come from, where they're trying to get to, and the training camps they've put in, and how tough the fight is. So yeah, it's become one of those where I'm just like, just watch it as a fan now.
Yeah, but like, I hear what you're saying, because I know both Isaac and Chris, so maybe that's why I was feeling a bit of anxiety. Like, I almost, that protector instinct, like, you want to go and help them.
You want both people to do well, right? No matter what the outcome is, you want them to go in there and have a good fight and do well and continue going on from there and firstly and mostly they come out safe. I think that's probably the most important thing, especially when they're having a slugfest.
Yeah, and that was one, yeah. But yeah, them fighters, like, did you see Ben Whitaker's debut? Yeah, obviously that was on that same night. That's just, it's just electric, isn't it? Anyway, yeah. I'll try not to get too bogged down in boxing chat.
Well, we can save that for another day because we can go on all day about that.
Yeah. So I suppose, like, where a nice place to start would be, because I'm just fascinated, is what your call it working week, but your general week looks like, because you've got so much going on. So how are you balancing everything, and what's your routine generally look like, the flow through the week?
Yeah, it's like recently I've had to change it a lot because there's been so many big deals going down and so many different crossover in different industries. Like, I've had to really figure out what we're talking about earlier. How am I going to continue to perform at such a high level? And this high performance stuff has been something I've been really researching a lot more recently than ever. I've always had an interest in it, but I think when I did the OFTV deal, it was such a big deal. And I knew that the job ahead and task ahead was going to be so tough. Like, with boxing, I feel like I can do it standing on my head. But because I took on this new role where I'm a co-creator and executive producer of the show, it's new territory for me, and I'm dealing with a big corporation, and they want me to make sure that I deliver what I said I was going to deliver, and also I've got to do that to get the money. So it was like, okay, well, I've got a lot of boxing clients, a lot of sports clients who I'm doing commercial deals for as well. I've got an influencer division that is constantly ticking over, and people need looking after in that. My sisters play a big part in that too. And if you've ever worked with a sibling, it's very demanding, and I love them to bits, but they'll just call me in the middle of the night and say, hey, what's going on with this? I'm like, listen, I'm going to bed. So, and then obviously working with OF and the team at OF, which has been an amazing experience so far. So this time around, I've realized that if I'm going to do this, I need to get the right team in place, and you can't do everything yourself. And that's kind of tough for me because I'm a bit of a control freak anyway. So I don't really like, sorry, my dogs are kicking off. I don't really like to let anybody do anything for me, or I don't really trust many people. Maybe that's because it's been something that I've been hurt in the past. But right now I've brought in a team where I've brought in an amazing coach who was given to me by the great Dan Lawrence, who we both know. He brought in a coach for me called Alex from Train With Intent, who's an amazing coach, works with me on a day-to-day basis. I've got a mind coach who we were talking about earlier called Greg Meehan at Rise. And then I brought in a personal chef who comes in. He cooks all of my food for me, and we was talking quite a bit about the product in front of us, and I've got quite a lot of intolerances, so I don't really let a lot of people cook for me. So having food available and good nutritional food to help fuel me for my days was really important, especially when you're working with like America, who are in completely different time zone. All of a sudden my days have gone from like normal starts to really late finishes. So I had to kind of figure out, I can't be skipping meals anymore, I can't be trying to train and not be fueled, and I'm not likely going to be getting up into my kitchen and just, you know, trying to put some food together. So I made sure I got the right team around me, and I called that the Hollywood team, because I felt like this is what the Hollywood stars have, or the high performers in sports. If you look at someone like LeBron James, who's an extreme example, but he's famously said that he spends $1 million a year on just his team, and his team that helping him to perform at the highest level. So I knew that if I was going to be working at this sort of level and across this sort of money, that I had to invest it into myself. And that was the first thing that I did.
Mate, that's huge. I love it. Absolutely love that. I think that because, like, if I look at some consistencies across the guests, that high performers have a very varied week. Like, it is incredibly diverse. You're diving into a deal over here, then you're going to go and do this over here, and there's multiple things going on, which is really great from a, if we talk about like neuroscience, because you allow your focus to shift from one thing to the next, which means chemically you can dial in and focus on one thing, then have a break from that, go into another thing, dial in and focus on that, rather than this, you know, almost mundane single focus thing on one thing throughout, you know, all week, month, year. So that's a massive thing. But the downside of that is, because it is so varied, you have to work almost every day to find that new routine. you know, like, you know, up earlier this morning, or, you know, I'm at home yesterday morning and it's like, okay, I've got an hour extra yesterday. I've got not as much time this morning or whatever it is. So to hear that you've built that team like that sounds outstanding. I love the, you know, I know that LeBron James quote as well.
Yeah. And then actually one important point I've been working on a lot is trying to find personal downtime.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people can get sucked into just working 24/7. And I've been a victim of that before, where I've just worked all day, every day, 7 days a week. But ultimately, we need to find some sort of balance. And I think we need to understand what we're actually working for. And I just wanted to try and implement some like downtime, and whether that's reading a book at night or reading a book first thing in the morning or listening to a podcast, or maybe it's just taking my dogs out for a walk with my missus after dinner. You know, when you have loved ones involved as well, you have to make sure that you find the right balance for them, because all they see is you working all the time. And my missus will come into my office and say like, come on, like, you need to just come out for a bit, or you need to come and do it. And I'm like, no, I need to just be here because I've got things to finish. And I'm very militant, but I won't finish my day unless everything that I've set out to do is done. So I've got a bit of that in me, but it's hard to take it away when it's got you to where you are, you know?
Mate, I really relate to that, because there's always something more to do as well, isn't there?
Oh, listen, I finish my day and I think, right, I think maybe there's a few more things I can squeeze in.
Yeah.
But it's not good for you being like that.
Nah.
It takes away the balance, and that's probably the hardest thing you need to do. You need to find is the right balance.
But I suppose it's prioritizing, isn't it? Like, I know I could reel off three or four things that I've let slip all week, but I suppose it's just allowing myself to go, yeah, it's okay. You know, I'll get back to them tonight, or over the weekend, I'll just have half an hour or whatever it is. Because otherwise you could just sit there every single night until midnight doing things.
Yeah.
I love that, mate. How would you advise people who are perhaps looking for some sort of team or some sort of support unit that can help them to succeed and perform?
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day, because my example is probably a mid to high range example, and it does cost quite a bit of money to invest into it. So I was trying to think about, how would you design a team like this, maybe on a budget or maybe for free? And I think the things that I used to do before I got to this point, and how I even learned about this, was one, just connecting with people. And you can do that for free. You don't need to pay people just to connect with them and have a conversation with them. And you'll be surprised with how many people you know, or how many people you know who can introduce you to somebody. And I think that's quite important. So connecting with people. I think YouTube's a great tool now. Like, it's got so much information on there, and you can find a lot of great stuff, like this podcast, for example, that you're doing. There's so many great people on this podcast that, okay, you might not get, or you might not digest everything for the whole hour, but there might be a few minutes of greatness in there that you could take in and you could listen to and you could implement it into your day. So YouTube, podcasts, anything like that, reading books. Like, I've got really into reading again. I went for a big stint a few years ago where I was reading all the time. And then I just got real busy and just met my missus, and, like, you know, it was just fell in love, and kind of books just kind of got lost. And now I've kind of got back into it, and I'm trying to like read a lot more and find things that I'm interested in rather than just reading novels and stuff like that. I think I'm trying to read more self-help books and something that I can actually use for my day. So there's lots of different ways you can do stuff.
Yeah, it's great. I love that, because you can also, I've thought about a lot about this recently. You know, if you're looking at a mentor or a coach, a mentor can be someone who doesn't even, he's not even on the planet anymore. Like, I listen to Jim Rohn, one of the founding fathers of personal development, every week. He died like 30 years ago or something. I would consider him a mentor. We can all find these people around, right? So, mate, if we dial the clock back to even before TOWIE, right, before we went on TV, something I find really interesting, we often reflect on these periods in our life, but the decision to leave school at 16, I think, is quite fascinating. And even more so to go into the work that you did. Is that like an Essex thing? Because I often find that a lot of people are driven into that world of like trading and bonds and where you went. Is that accurate or not?
Yeah, I think that is pretty accurate. I left school at 16 because I just hated school, which is really weird now because I love educating myself. So I think like done a full 360. But when I was at school, I just had no interest in like listening to teachers. I always wanted to be like a class clown and mess around and do silly stuff, play football. And like, you know, that was kind of like my school life. And then as soon as 16 come around, I was like, Dad, I don't want to go to a sixth form or university or college or anything like that. I just want to go to work. So I think off the back of my GCSE results, they were like, yeah, I don't think school's for you. So let's try and get you into work. So kind of dust around for a little bit, had a job here and there. And, you know, actually an important, this was a real important lesson in life. My dad said to me, you can leave school and go to work, but I want you to understand what happens if you don't do well. And he got me a job. And at the time, his boxing gym was next to an industrial estate. And there was a big t-shirt factory there, like, and they were printing t-shirts like all day. And he got me a job in the t-shirt factory. And my shift was 6 a.m. to like, I don't know, early afternoon or whatever. But I had to work in a t-shirt factory, man. And I promise you now, that was so hard. I like, nobody would talk to me. I had to like, my job was literally just lifting the t-shirts off the heater and folding them. And starting at 6 a.m., 16-year-old kid, I was like, what the hell is going on here? Like, I'm used to like getting up at like 8, literally putting my clothes on and going to school by like 8:30. So like doing that was a real culture shock for me. And he was like, you know, if you don't, not necessarily do well, but like, this is the other end of it. This is the working man side of it. And you have to choose what you want to be or what you want to do, because there is another side of this world that you can go on and do something. So I said, right, okay, I've had enough of this. So I want to actually, you know, I want to be a broker, because that's like, that seems to be where the money's at, and driving fast cars and nice suits. And that was all I really knew at 16. So my dad was like, well, I don't really know anybody who's a broker, but I do have a friend of a friend who might know someone. So he asked around, and this guy got me a job. And he said, look, it's 2 weeks work experience. It's not a job. It's 2 weeks work experience. But just go in there and give it your all, because you never know. They might call you back. So I went in there, met some real interesting characters, people that are still friends that I talk to now. My boss and my really good friend who's a mind coach, he worked there, who's my mind coach now, he worked there. And man, that was like the Wolf of Wall Street. Like, it was mad. Like, I did not expect it to be anything like that. I thought that these guys were going to be like real sophisticated corporate guys. And like, it was that kind of industry, but they did not care. They were wild, and like, they just wanted to go out and party and drink and spend loads of money. And I had no idea that that was like what that world was going to be like. So I got quickly captivated into that. And I worked there for a long time, like 4 or 5 years, and it was a whirlwind, but I loved it. And everybody became like family, because I was doing like 11, 12 hour days and then going out with them in the evening and entertaining. I spent more time there than I did at home. So, you know, that was an interesting part of my life. And you're right, like, a lot of Essex people do actually become brokers, but that's because to be a trader, I think you have to be really like, these guys are like super educated, and like, they are actually trading the bank's money. Yeah. To be a broker, you do have to be educated, but it was also a lot about relationships and having relationships with the traders. And we were just doing the middleman work, you know, between that trader and that trader. So we were just nicking the part in the middle. And I think a lot of Essex guys have the gift of the gab, and they can sell ice to the Eskimos. And that was what we were good at. And that's why a lot of Essex people tend to go into the city and do that job.
You enjoy it?
Yeah, I loved it. Like, I loved it. I look back on it, obviously I was really young. I was like 17, 16, 17, right through to 21, 22. So I didn't really know who I was or what I was doing at that point in my life, but I was kind of having a good time. I was on a roller coaster. It was fun. You know, I was getting taken here, there and everywhere. I was learning a lot about London, and it was pretty cool, man. Like, I enjoyed it at the time. Like I said, I made some like really good friends out of it. So, you know, my ethos has changed a little bit, and I'm not really into that kind of lifestyle anymore or career path. But, you know, I think there's some good people there, and I was happy that I met them along the way. And they taught me a lot about who I am today, and they taught me a lot about how to negotiate. And I think that played a big part in some of the deals that you've seen me do recently.
Yeah, amazing, man. It's so great when you can look back and be grateful for those moments. I imagine it hardened you to a degree as well.
Thick skin. Mm. You know, I got called all sorts at that job. And there was a few moments where I was like, I don't know if I can do this. I remember going home and I was like, Dad, crying. And I was like 16, 17, crying. And I was like, man, I don't know if I can do this. It's hard. Like, they're pushing me to the limit and they're calling me all sorts of names. And on top of that, the job is like, there's people queuing up for the job. So to actually make it and do well, you've got to be good. So I worked my ass off and I did all right. I actually become one of the youngest brokers on the floor, like to actually start trading. So that was a pretty good achievement for me. Pretty proud moment.
Yeah, it's so fascinating when we see the things that are important when we look back. Like sometimes I realize how important and how much they shape us. But interested to know about like the culture. Was there like a lot of drug taking in that period of time?
Yeah, there were. And I think brokers and more well-known for it. Like, again, it was a hard job. There was a lot of early mornings and late nights and entertaining people and connecting with people. And they had to be on it all the time. And I don't really remember too much happening during the office period, but anytime we got out after the office had finished, it was heavily alcohol and drug fueled nights. And I weren't really into the drugs or the alcohol, to be honest. I was just a lightweight kid, you know. I couldn't really handle anything. But I think there was a lot of pressure to do stuff, especially when you're hanging around with older guys who are in their late 30s and 40s and stuff. And it was an interesting time for me because it made me learn a lot about who I am. And I think there's a lot of young kids that could get sucked into that and can get pressured into that. And then there's that moment where you have to say, well, actually, that's not who I'm going to be, you know. So that was always me. But I think...
What allowed you to do that, like to stay true to yourself?
I just came from a family, I think, who drummed it into me that drugs just isn't the way, like, you know. And my family came from an era where drugs were big, you know, in the 80s and stuff like that, like heroin and cocaine. Like that was a big era for drugs. So I think they see what maybe friends and families went through, and then they kind of drummed it into their kids that don't get involved in that. You don't have to be that person to have a good time. So that was always me, but there was a lot of pressure from people. And it was only now that I look back on, these people weren't trying to give me drugs or trying to fuel me with alcohol because they just wanted me to do it. They were trying to do it for some sort of acceptance to why they were doing it. And drug and alcohol abusers, they don't want to hang with normal people or people who don't want to be on their level, because they just want to have those good times, good highs, hang with people who are going to do that sort of stuff. So if they can get you into it, one, it's an acceptance, and two, you've just become a part of the gang. You know, we can go, this is the going out gang. And that was all it really was. It weren't because they were bad people or because they were just trying to feed you stuff. It was just because they were on it and they wanted people to hang with and they wanted to feel accepted for it.
Man, I love that. Not to go too deep and heavy on this, but all of those things are driven from our own insecurities, aren't they? Like, they want to be accepted. The other person wants to be accepted, but we can all accept ourselves to avoid going down those paths to a degree. But something that, like, so, you know, you spoke about The Only Way is Ethics, the TV show. What's immediately coming to mind is you then were staying true to yourself on the show as well, right? Which ultimately left or ended in you leaving. How did it come about then? So you were working in the city, you were a broker when the opportunity came about, or what was the story there?
Yeah, my sister was in the show. She was in like the first series, and she'd done extremely well, and it just become like an overnight phenomenon. Like everybody started watching it and talking about it. And then I was in that job and I was doing okay. Like I was doing well, but the market had taken a bit of a turn and people started to lose their jobs and started to get made redundant. And I don't think that I was ever going to lose my job or get made redundant because I was young and I probably wasn't a high roller like the others, you know, were on big paychecks. So I think I was always safe in that degree, but there was a real bad taste going around the floor and it wasn't a positive environment to be around. And, you know, I'd done all right. Like, you know, I was doing okay. And I felt like I was young enough that I could try something else. And if that didn't work, I could always come back. And everybody at the broker firm, especially my boss at the time, Max, he was very much like, just go and try it, mate, and give it your best shot because it could work out really well for you. And if it doesn't, just come back. And that was kind of like how that started. So big shout out to Joey and Chloe who got me in the show. And I joined The Only Way is Essex first first filming opportunity I shot at was the only way is Marbella. They flew me out and I had this amazing scene with Joey and it was a real introduction, deep scene, and they cut it out. So no one ever saw it. And it was a really cool scene. And then they were like, actually, we're just gonna wrap up Marbella and then we're gonna come back to Essex and you can start filming in Essex. And then that was where I started.
So what did that look like initially? Because I think part of this podcast is around these leaps of faith, right, of which you've had many. That sounds like a big one. You know, I know you're saying that it was getting a bit toxic on the floor and stuff, but you had success in the trading floor, in that environment, in that world. You sort of picked up on maybe the fact that the market was dipping and it wasn't going to continue to have the success there that it had been. But you're still taking a chance. You're still taking a risk. And you said shout out to Chloe and Joey for getting you on. But so was it an invitation to come on? Was it like they had said, bring Charlie in, or how did it look?
Yeah, I mean, they were very interested in like building a family dynamic and they still are, like, you know, even up to the last series, you know, hence why my sisters are all on the show is because they want it to be like a family watch show and they were really interested in who the family are, other family members were. So I was interviewed a few times before I got on it. But the first couple of times I wasn't really sure. Like I kind of said, I'm not really interested, or they said it weren't the right time. And then the third time was the time where I took that leap of faith. And I remember that moment so clearly. Like I remember sitting down with mum and dad were proud of me for the job that I had anyway. And I was like, look, this is what's happening at work. This is the opportunity I'm being presented with. What do you think? And they weren't particularly fond of the idea of me doing it, to be honest. They was like, why don't you just stay where you are? And we'll touch on this in a bit. But my parents come from a background, right, where they've not always had it easy and neither did their parents. And they come from very humble beginnings. So I was always motivated by them to be in a safe job. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. But that was just never who I was. And it's not who I am today. And at the time, they were very much like, look, you've got a job. It's solid. It's paying you every month. Just, you know, why don't you stay there and just see where it goes? And I was like, you know, I'm not really feeling it. I'm not particularly happy there. And I don't feel like it's the right environment for me. So I want to change. I want to do something. And, you know, by the way, I was watching Joey and Chloe earn a lot of money by doing fuck all. Like literally I was getting up 5 a.m. every day, getting into my office before the market starts, like 6:37. These guys were like partying and like just doing a bit of filming here and there and being flown to Marbella or Ibiza. And I was like, man, what the fuck's going on? Like, I just feel like I could do that, you know? So that was a lot of the motivation really from making the leap, but it wasn't the easiest job for me. I felt like I had to be somebody who I wasn't a lot of the time. And I was wrapped up in a real bad situation. Like a lot of people go on these reality TV shows and you look at them. They are me, myself, and I. Like they come on their own, they defend themselves, and that's it. I went onto that show and I had multiple family members on it. And I was in a relationship that was very volatile. And that whole dynamic made it a very rough experience for me because my family didn't get on with her and she didn't get on with my family. And it made it very tough for me. And I had to make tough decisions during that time period that I probably wasn't ready or experienced enough to make. So it was quite a rough time period for me. And sometimes thinking about it, I try not to because I try to almost blur it out a bit and try to make it something that I don't really want to get into because there was a lot of negativity around that time of my life. But also it was the time of my life that people know me for. So, you know, it was an unusual, unique experience.
It's funny, mate. One of my mentors tells me there's polarity in everything, you know? So even in those great moments that you achieve amazing things, there's also negative things that come with that. And even in these really dark negative moments around the period you've just explained, there's also loads of positives that gave you the platform and, you know, exposure as well. So I think that's a nice way to think about a lot of things. Like, you know, when things are really great, cool, but there's polarity in everything, the same when it's negative. What helped you to make the difficult decisions during that period? And what, I mean, you know, if you want to pick one, or if you just want to like allude to some of the things that you took from making those decisions.
Well, I think to just explain what happened, I'd left a solid job to go on to a TV show, which then became my new job that paid me money each month to pay my bills and pay for my rent and cars. Then I had my relationship showcased to the world, to somebody that I thought I was in love with at the time. She was on the show with me, and I had my family there as well. So everything that you would regard as your safe zone, your financial situation, your relationship, intimate relationship, and your family were all in one place, and it was very volatile. So everything that I'd originally felt very safe around didn't become a safe zone for me anymore. So for me, it was very much like I needed to get out of this situation, and it weren't easy for me. And you'll see that there were some famous tweets on from back in those years. I can't remember when it was, 2014, 15 or whatever. But I made the decision to leave the show, to leave my girlfriend at the time. And I actually stopped talking to Chloe, my sister, my oldest sister, for about a year to 18 months after that period. We just completely cut contact. And that was a real tough thing for me to do, because she was my big sister and I looked up to her, and we just had a really bad relationship on the show. Like, it just didn't work, and mainly because of the person I was with at the time. But we just couldn't see eye to eye on certain things, and birthdays and Christmases became quite awkward, like, you know, during that period. I had no money, financial income coming in, and I was going through a difficult time of a breakup. So, you know, that's why I don't really like talking or going back there. But all of that taught me, really, when I look back, was that I need to make better decisions in life, man, you know, and you need to figure out who people are, who you are. You need to just be authentic to yourself. And that was all it was. I knew I was giving up everything. Everything that was safe to me, I was giving it up, because I knew I had to start again. And that was a real difficult period and a real difficult decision, just to chuck it all in one thing. And that's what happened, really. I just said, enough's enough. Don't want to be part of this no more. I'm going to go and get on with my life. But I used that to fuel me into the next chapter, because I was like, that chapter isn't going to define me. I'm going to go on and do something with my life. I'm going to go on and be someone and make sure I meet the right person and have the right people around me.
That's amazing courage, mate. Amazing courage. And I think that question of who am I is like the biggest question that we can ask ourselves, right? And I think, like, it's actually one of the first things that I do when I sit down with a new client, is to help them to identify the difference between the internal world, which is all that we are, and our true selves. No matter how disconnected you are from that, like, you always have a level of connection, you've just got to find it again, versus the external world. All the flashing lights, cars, you know, nightclubs, all of that noise out there that tries to distract us from who we really are. It's hard, man. I can't even imagine how challenging that is when your own family is, like, arguably more invested in the external world and you're trying to maintain your authenticity.
I think we were all just trying to figure out who we were. Like, we were all just really young. We were thrown into this crazy show of, like, fame and fortune, and there was millions of people watching the show a week, and then becoming, you know, just trying to go down the shops at the time was difficult, you know, without getting stopped and asked for a photograph or something like that. So we were all just trying to figure out who we were and what we were going to do with our lives, because we were all so young. I was like 22, 23. Chloe was like 30, Joey was like 25. So, and a lot of the guys were that sort of age in that, at that time. So we were just trying to figure out who we were. But I think authenticity is like the biggest thing that I stand by today, especially, like, even when I'm doing stuff today in business, especially if I don't like something, I'm not a company man. I'm just not, that just isn't who I am. And I can't sleep at night knowing that either I've said something wrong to somebody, or they've done something wrong to me, and I reacted maybe not in an authentic way. And I think I have to do things my way or the highway because I just can't sleep at night. And that moment for me, that big moment in my life, which changed a lot of things for me, for walking away from that, all of that, I walked away from TV, from fame, from money, from a relationship, from a family. I just knew that something had to change for the better. I just couldn't be part of that anymore. So authenticity is a big thing for me today, especially when I'm doing deals, when I'm signing clients. If I don't like the deal, sometimes you have to put money aside. And I know there's a lot of people out there that are like relentless or just work with somebody because, you know, they're going to pay you and you're going to reach goals that you need to get to. But that's never been me. That's never been who I am. And I've always done things on my own terms. And maybe that has cost me money or relationships somewhere, but I'll always continue to do that just because it just helps me sleep a bit better at night.
Yeah, amazing, mate. Your morals and your values, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nipsey Hussle said, I'd rather be at peace with myself and at war with the world than at war with myself and at peace with the world.
Mate, you ask anybody who works for me, they'll tell you I'm hard work, but not because I'm trying to be hard work. It's just because morally it needs to fit in with who I am and what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've always been like that.
I love that, mate. Thanks. And thanks for sharing that. I know it's hard to talk about that stuff. So, mate, the next chapter, could you go on then to achieve some incredible things? And there's obviously some part of you that's an absolute operator anyway. So what happened next as far as like, because, you know, you can look at your family and particularly your dad, who's like, you know, one of the best at what he does in the world of boxing. And you can see what you're doing and working with boxers now. And it'd be very easy to go, oh, you know, it's Charlie's dad, so he's got him. But you went and worked at Wasserman for 3 years, almost like earning your stripes, I suppose. Did you always know you were going to like create huge or work with athletes or be in that world? Or what was that like?
I'll tell you what happened. So I had the coffee shop, which is one of the things we touched on very early on. I had the coffee shop.
I bought mugs, by the way, off your...
Oh, wicked. Yeah.
The YOLO and you mug one.
Yeah, I still got about 1,000 of them if you want any. So I set up the coffee shop. And the coffee shop was more of an idea from my family at the time. Like, it wasn't really my idea. And again, I was very young. I was like 21 when I set this up, 22. And I just got involved in something that I didn't really have any passion for. I liked food and coffee and, you know, we all do. We all struggle to go a day without drinking a cup of coffee. But I think when you're pouring it out every day, you have to be real passionate about it. So I kind of left the show, had the shop still, decided to sell the shop because it just wasn't who I was. And then that moment came where I had to sit down with myself and say, right, who are we going to be now? You've got a fresh start, a fresh slate. What do you want to do? Dad was having a real, real good time in boxing. Like he was starting to lay foundations for building that team that made him who he is today. Yeah, the Darren Barker, Kevin Mitchell, Ricky Burns, Lee Purdy, who went on to fight for world title, all these great fighters coming through. Martin J. Ward, John Ryder was coming through. And he was at part in and around that gym at the time. So Matchroom had just come along, started investing a lot of money. He was working closely with Eddie, and Eddie was trying to make boxing sexy again. So that era had come along and he was like, look, I'm getting a lot of people ringing me to do endorsement deals and sponsorship deals with my boxers. And I'm a manager and I'm not an agent. And what you just done in the TV world, well, actually, just to rewind a little bit, When I got into TOWIE, it was all about Twitter. This is quite an important thing. It was all about Twitter. Twitter was a big tool, a social platform and tool at the time. Then Instagram just started to come along and people were posting photos. And I weren't really sure about Instagram at first, but this was when it first started to come along. So we built some decent followings along that, started doing some influencing along with Instagram. So now fast forward again. My dad's telling me, you know, these guys want to do social media deals and endorsement deals. And I don't really know what that is. So you've been doing a little bit about that. Do you want to help maybe do some deals? Well, I knew nothing about negotiating an athlete endorsement deal or a sponsorship deal, but I did know a little bit about social media. So I got involved in helping kind of advise and negotiate the deals. And I think my first deal, I think I made like 300 quid, but man, I was fucking chuffed with that. You know, that was a real fucking moment for me where I was like, yeah, I've done something, you know, I've done something that I feel good about, and I helped somebody with their journey, because ultimately that money that I negotiated for them helped them to go on and train and help, you know,
support. Who was it?
It was John Ryder.
Was it John?
Yeah, it was John Ryder at the time. And the company was just a small company. So, you know, John was chuffed with that at the time. And that was my first real moment of like saying, yeah, this is what I want to do. I've got a bit of a buzz for this. And then those deals started rolling in. And I became an agent, commercial agent, for first year, 18 months. Started doing okay, working with Anthony Joshua quite a bit. I was doing events with Anthony Joshua, like mainly when he came onto the scene, and I was doing all right. And then I met Wasserman, and I sat down with my dad and I was like, listen, you know, I'm doing okay. Like, I had my own company called Sim Sports Management at the time, and I was just a one-man band. And I was like, you know, I want to take this seriously. I want to do this seriously. And I think the best thing for me to do would be to go and get a job at a big corporation, big agency. Wasserman were the biggest sports agency at the time, and go and work there and learn how to really do this. And he was like, yeah. So I had a contact there, and Dean Baker, he kind of brought me under his wing, and he'd set up a very small boxing department, who at the time was George Groves and Andy Ogogo. And Anthony Ogogo had a bit of momentum. He came out of the Olympics, won the bronze medal, and George Groves had fought Froch by this time. He might have even fought Froch in the second fight, I can't remember. But yeah, he was a big name. And they were like, we want to develop a boxing department. We've got everything, you know, football, rugby, athletics, all Olympic sports, but we want a boxing department. So I kind of came in and worked very closely with their team and helped develop them, brought all the great fighters that or in my stable today. They were like real young at the time. John Ryder, Martin Ward, Connor Benn, all of them guys, they came with me to Wasserman, and I worked real closely on developing their profiles. Then I think after about another year or so, I decided that actually I'd done a lot of commercial deals. I want to be a manager, and I want to advise people, and I want to start helping people with their contracts, and start talking to Eddie Hearn directly and negotiating with the big boys. And that was kind of like my next big step. And I was doing that at Wasserman for a bit. And then, I don't know, I said I had like a real Jerry Maguire moment. And anybody who's watched Jerry Maguire,
favorite film.
Yeah, you'll understand that he works at this big agency and he's got all these clients and actually everything in his life's fine. But he just says, you know what? This just isn't me. I want less clients. I want to put more time into them, and I want to do this on my own terms. And that was kind of what happened to me. And that was when the huge project was born. And I left, negotiated a deal. I had about a year left on my contract with Wasserman, negotiated a deal out, and then set up the huge project. One of the funny things about setting up the huge project was I set it all up. I was real excited. We launched it and the pandemic hit. Literally like a month or two afterwards, lockdown, Boris shut everybody down and was like, everyone stay at home, no more sporting events. Bam. Damn, I was out of business real quick. And I was like, what's next? And this is a big part. This point that I'm going to make is a big part of everything we've spoken about up to this point and everything that I've gone on to do. Adaption. We need to adapt. Because if we don't adapt and we just stay still, we're just going to die. And unfortunately, that period of time, it was out of our control. There was nothing we could do. So what did I do? What was booming at the time? Social media. Everybody who had shops, retail, sports events, it all went down. But social media was still up and running. Influencers become huge. And we needed to get into that market. And that's what we did. We got into it.
Mate, it's insane. You know what jumps out to me about that more than anything is how we all want everything overnight, don't we? But you made it's almost like a strategic decision, but it was led by here, like by your heart. And you went to Wasserman for 3 years. You took the boxers, you know, the big lads with you, but you earned your stripes and you grafted, and then that's what led you to do huge. And then even when you just made that difficult decision, because I can't imagine it was easy to take the leap of faith from Wasserman either, right? You got that resource and support and one of the best agencies, and then you go out on your own again, and then COVID hits. It's like hit after hit after hit, and those obstacles stack up. So, mate, just listening to it, it's incredibly inspiring, first of all, but it's also for people listening, like, it doesn't happen overnight. It's fucking difficult, and it's supposed to be. It's really hard. And I think like humility is such a big part of that, which you've displayed kind of time and time again there, like understanding that I don't know everything. I want to do this properly. I'm going to go to Wasserman. Now's the time for me to try again. Fuck, another stumbling block, right? Reassess and adapt, as you said. I think it's outstanding, mate. I'm so pleased to see like how far you've gone with it already.
I think I just, by this point, I just got used to being out of the comfort zone. And when I was at Wasserman, I was very unhappy towards the end, but I think I was more unhappy with myself rather than the company or anybody who worked there, even though I gave them a bit of a rough time because I wanted to leave. I was actually just more unhappy with myself. And what had actually happened when I was at Wasserman, I'd got very comfortable living off of the paycheck.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but it just wasn't who I was. And I just wanted more than that. And I just wanted to go off and do it on my own terms and say that I, even if I didn't make as much,
yeah,
I just wanted to say that I made that for myself. And that was really, that was when I took the leap of faith. And that was when I was like, okay, well, we're back out of the comfort zone and the pandemic's happening and this is real difficult. And if I'm going to make it, it's going to be now. Mm. Because I think anybody who wasn't passionate or who wasn't ready to adapt or step up, we're unfortunately going to sink. And I think those who were going to swim. And that was just the decision that I made. And this goes back to some of the earlier stuff we had where I was just working every day, like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just trying to figure out how to make this work, how to pay my bills at the end of the month.
So rewarding though when you figure it out, right?
Figured it out. We got involved in the influencer game. The influencer game business started getting as big as my boxing business. And we survived. We did all right. And we come out of that, thankfully. Boxing came. I think it took eight or nine months for the first real boxing event to come back. I think it might have even been...
was that Fight Camp?
Fight Camp. Yeah, I think it was Fight Camp. And man, what an event that was. That was just awesome, you know, just to be a part of that. That feels like that's something that will go down in history, I think, in boxing, you know, British boxing. You know, we'll talk about Fight Camp for years to come because there was some awesome fights on Fight Camp.
I spoke with Eddie for the 100th episode of this show, and I spoke with Barry, it's coming out in a couple of weeks actually after yours, about that. And you have a very similar outlook as well, just to make things happen. Also, I want to acknowledge, because you said it a number of times, is it just wasn't me. And rather than being unhappy with the situation, you were unhappy with yourself. And that's accountability. And that's one of the most important skills, like you call it a soft skill, but one of the most important things that we can have as a skill, right? Because otherwise it's a blame culture. Let's point the finger at someone else because it hurts to take accountability because we're saying it's our fault, but it's also quite freeing afterwards when you go, okay, it's my fault, right? How can I do it differently? And I suppose that's like the tangible to how we adapt, right?
Yeah, and I just feel like going back to that authenticity, like you just want to do stuff that you feel proud of doing. And I could have stayed at Wasserman. I could have probably renewed my contract and stayed and probably just stayed in the comfort zone. I just knew deep down I wanted something more than that. And I didn't really even know what that was at that time. I just knew that that wasn't for me and I needed to move on. And I think it probably was the best decision that I've made like in my career so far was to kind of take a leap of faith and do something different and get out of the comfort zone.
I mean, I'm very pro that as well, given that I've done the same thing. I recognize there are people out there who maybe their leap of faith is like the next promotion or something else, but I can only speak to doing it for yourself. How you said, when you figure those things out for yourself, you earn the money for yourself. It's so rewarding. And to grow a business, you have to grow personally and you're forced to. Like, it's, for me, I love it, mate. I love it. So I think that's why we're aligned and connected because we've got the same sort of passions. But you said there, like you wanted to start doing deals with the big boys. I'd love to know your involvement in like, let's say like a Conor Ben Eubank Jr. fight. And then also like the OFTV stuff, like, A, what's your involvement? And also, how are you making sure you're getting the most in those situations from yourself?
So I like to call myself an advisor now. I went for a management stage. Management's very different. Management is like you manage everything for these people. And I was doing the management agent dual job at the time. And that's when you literally do everything, cover every basis. You're literally doing the deals for them, managing the commercial deals. You're talking about their fight kit. You're doing everything for them at the time. And I did that for a number of years. But now I'm at the point where I'm more of an advisor. And that for me is probably the highest, in terms of like hierarchy in the job roles, that's probably the highest role that you can take in what I do. And that's when you sit down with an athlete and you sit them down and you go through the contract or the deal and you specify what it is they're trying to achieve. And sometimes the athlete won't know and sometimes they will know. And it's just about trying to figure out and navigate how to get this deal in position that works for them. And that's basically what I do. So for example, for the Eubank Ben fight, we negotiated that deal with Matram and Eddie. And I was a part of the negotiations from the very off. And Connor's got quite a unique team because he's got Tony, my dad, as his trainer slash manager. So they work more across the opponents and stuff like that. And then he's got a lawyer called Liam Touch, who's a good friend of mine. And he does all the legal side. And then you've got me, who's the advisor. So I'll go in and pick the deal apart, pick the contract apart. And then I'll speak with Lee about the legals and he'll help go through the language of the legals because that's ultimately what that is. It's a different language. So he'll tell me how things are written, how he feels about maybe changing certain terms and clauses. But my deal, my role ultimately is to make sure that Conor Benn gets not just financially the best deal for him, but just to make sure that he's comfortable within the deal itself. And that could be anything from ring walks to names on the posters to training camps to make sure he's getting every single thing to help him because once that deal is done, Conor Benn then goes into a whole different job role, which is training camp. And he needs to go into that training camp making sure he's 100% happy with what he signed up to. Because if he isn't, that camp mentally isn't going to go so smoothly. So my job is to really come in and make sure that he is 100% happy with every single thing that he's signing up to before he gets into that stage. And then that stage is where Tony comes in, Dan Lawrence comes in, and they start working through the camp. And then then I'll likely come back around more like fight week and start working with him across his fight week commitments, like his media commitments, the weigh-in, press conference. And then again, I'm a little bit different for Conor because I still do his commercial stuff. So I'll do his sponsorship deals and make sure that the brands are all aligned and make sure that everybody's happy with what they're getting and the money's coming in and stuff like that. But if we're talking about like John Ryder, for example, when he fought Danny Jacobs, I advised John Ryder on that deal. And again, some deals this is part of like, again, the sport that people don't understand. Danny Jacobs didn't want to come to London to fight John Ryder. But there wasn't any budget for John Ryder to go to America to fight Danny Jacobs. So we were then had to have a very frank conversation with Matchroom about, well, how much budget do you have? How much does Danny Jacobs want and how much can we get? And we had to negotiate that deal to a point where John felt comfortable and happy with that deal. Danny Jacobs wanted a lot of money. So he soaked up a lot of the budget. And sometimes you have to have a very honest conversation with John and say, is this the fight that you actually want to take? Because the money might not be where we wanted it to be. But ultimately, here's the pros, here's the cons. And this is what's going to happen if you win or if you lose. And John will make that decision for himself because he's the only person who gets in the ring and fights. And the outcome really is down to him.
Where's that money come from? Because as far as I understand it, like when Eddie explained it to me, they secure a venue, they get brand sponsors in to pay the fighter purses, and then Matchroom take the tickets. Is that how it's broken down? Or is that too simplified?
I think it's a little bit different now.
Okay.
I think that might have been, yeah, that no, that probably is right in unusual circumstances, but they also get a lot of money from DAZN. DAZN are pumping a lot of money into the sport. They're trying to build a new platform. So DAZN will cover a lot of the production and a lot of the fighters' purses. The ticket money will also come with the profit side of it. So let's just say, for example, the O2 Arena holds 19,000, I think, something like that. The ticket, if you sell out the O2 Arena, I think the ticket revenue is £1 million, something like that. So if you can get your show paid for, production and the fighters and the main event and the undercard paid for by DAZN and some sponsorship, and then you're looking at taking the ticket money as your profit, well, you've only got to bang that out and you've made £1 million a show. I'm not saying that that's always the case, because, you know, you might only make a fraction of that million, but I think some, you know, and pay-per-view is a whole different model itself. Like, pay-per-view is like crazy money. Like, if you hit pay-per-view, you've cracked it, you know. So and it's quite hard to go back from pay-per-view as well, but ultimately that's how you build the promotional side. I don't really get too involved on how they would work that side. Like, I'm more just on the fire side.
So then your advising comes from like the split purse, for example. So let's use John again as an example. So your, you know, opponent wants X amount and you're advising John or helping him to make a decision on what he's prepared to take, like percentage split?
Yeah.
Right.
So we're now negotiating a deal. I don't know if I can say his name, but somebody in America, where John's going to go and fight someone in America. So we're looking at that deal. We're trying to figure out how much. You know, America's so different because you have to pay withholding tax there too. Mm. So we're trying to figure out like how much money he's going to get in dollars to sterling. Does the sterling, after he's paid his management fees, his trainers' fees, his camp, his withholding tax, does it clear enough of what he wants basically to take the fight? So there's a lot of things that you have to go through in order before you can make a decision on what you want to do. This isn't just a case of, oh, we'll pay you $100,000 and that's it. This is, you know, we'll give you $100,000, but you have to factor in all of these things. And then does that clear, you know, what you want to take home? So that's where a lot of the problems come. When people start saying, oh, we can't get the money right, it's not because we're just trying to agree one figure. It's because there's so many things to implement that in that deal that we're trying to figure out, does it balance up? Can we get any more money? And if we can't get money from the promotional side, can we get it from the sponsorship side to make it balance up a bit more? So that's what I come in and do. I just try and help the fighters figure out how much we can balance the deal up and does it work in their favor. That's basically what I do.
Mate, so interesting. Thanks for sharing that, because I think there's so much that people don't know, like you said. Yeah, mate, thanks again for sharing on the boxing side. Like, it's so fascinating. And even from a business perspective, you know, like to hear how, I suppose, in depth it is. It's really interesting. So I'd love to hear like on the other side of it then. So you were hugely involved in the OFTV and the series which is coming up, which you're saying you're going to LA for next month?
Yeah, so negotiated a big deal. It was like an 8-figure deal to co-create and produce a show with the brand new streaming platform OFTV, which is famously backed by OnlyFans. And we're going to start filming the first series in October. And yeah, we'll be in LA for that first series.
Amazing. So who's part of that team then who put that together? And how did that even work? Because obviously, famously, your sisters left the previous show that they were in order to pursue this.
Yeah, so Chloe had been part of that show for like 12 years. And the girls, Demi and Frankie, had been part of it for the last 3 or 4 years. Maybe a bit shorter than that. But they'd become like real influential characters on the show. And going back to what we were talking about earlier, they really wanted family dynamic on the show. And three sisters, like, it worked really well. But I just think that Chloe had been toying with the idea that she was getting to a point where she felt like she'd done, played her part. And I think she felt like it was ready for the next chapter for her. And she always said to me that she wanted to do something with the family, and we wanted our own show, and we wanted it to be very Kardashian-esque. And the girls, Demi and Frankie, were very much aligned with like that. So anyway, the next series of their previous shows coming up, we started negotiations for either a new contract for that show or exit strategies for that show. And we just weren't getting anywhere in the negotiations. So we then started shopping around, as you do. You start building the pitch and you start talking to different people. We shopped around and we had a couple of bites from some other broadcasters. And OF, I'd had some very small dealings with OF before. But I knew that this was a platform that I wanted to invest and grow. And I think because OF was so taboo and so the perception was so, it was a lot about explicit nudity and explicit content. And although that isn't what we're about, I knew from the press and the way that the CEO, Amy, and COO, Keely were talking about, they wanted to change the perception of that, especially in the UK. And in America, it's actually perceived very differently. It's perceived more like a social media platform, whereas in the UK, it's more about nudity and explicit content. So they wanted to change the perception of that. They'd been trying to change the perception of that, but nobody would take the leap of faith to do it. So I said, well, you have a platform called OFTV, and it was brand new at the time. And they were just uploading content to it. And it is almost like a free version of Netflix or Amazon Prime. You download it on your iPhone, Android, or smart TV. It's just an app. And you can access it like YouTube or like a Netflix. And they were really looking to pump big money into like turning this platform into their safe to work environment for people who didn't want to use OnlyFans. So we were like, look, our contracts are coming to an end with the other show. We're looking to do this. This was our idea. What do you think? Would you be interested? And that was where the negotiation started. And they were really interested, loved the idea. We loved it because it was a global reach and everything we was doing at the time was a national reach. And streaming for me is just where it's at. Like, I just think the future is going to be streaming. I think everybody's pretty much got smartphone or smart TV, and the global reach was really interesting too, because I think as a family, and when you look at the sisters in particularly, they're pretty famous in their field here. You know, like Chloe in particularly, she's probably peaked as much as she can doing that show here in the UK. So I think it was more about chasing a new adventure, trying to take on something brand new. And again, it was, we'll go back to comfort zones and new territory. You know, she was doing something that she was doing for 12 years and it had made her who she was, and it was her financial stability, and she's got a kid, and, you know, she had to make that leap of faith and it had to be right. And there were a lot of talks about, you know, is this the right thing to do? Is this the right time to do it? We negotiated an amazing deal with OF. They really backed us and believed in us. We really love them too. Like, God, they're so down to earth and so normal. And you almost want to be friends, you know, just be friends with these guys. They're so cool. And they just know where they want to put the show and how big they want it to be. And we did a lot of extensive research into this. It wasn't just a quick decision to be made. You know, I knew that their audience and their demographic was in the high 70s of America, hence why we're shooting our first series in LA. And the Kardashians, although an extreme example, there just aren't any other families knocking around. And I think the UK are just desperate to see a new family come in and follow a new setup. And that's what we're going to offer them. You know, I think it just all aligned at the right time. And it was just an amazing deal to do. And I'm super proud and happy that we got that over the line. And like I said, we start shooting in October. So first series is coming up and it's pretty real.
How long did it take to put the deal together?
Months. Well, not months, actually. I'd say I had conversations with them about doing something. But I'd say the real negotiating we got done quickly, like a couple of weeks. But like this conversation had been coming around for a long time, and I'd been working across different stuff with them for a long time because I wanted to do a podcast with them at one point. And, you know, we was talking about doing some smaller stuff with them across socials. And then I pitched them the idea of the show, but that really came together in a couple of weeks and it almost didn't feel real. Like it was just so big, bigger than anything I've ever done before in anything in my career. And you're throwing these sort of numbers around and you're like, we've signed the deal, but is this actually going to happen? You know, like, and then now it's happening. We're going to LA and we're shooting the show. And there was just this amazing moment where the girls, Demi, Frankie and Chloe came around my house. We'd signed the deal as a production company to produce this show. And then I had to tell them what they were earning. And I sat them down. I've got an office out the back with a big whiteboard. And I was like, I'm going to have to write this out because I don't think they're going to understand or digest what I'm telling them. It was like way bigger than anything they could have ever expected or dreamt of. You know, talking like seven-figure deals. And I started writing it out and I could see they were just like reading it and digesting it. And they were like, are you joking? I'm trying to do the Essex accent. Are you joking? And I was like, no, that's it. That's the deal. And like that, changed their life. So career high moment for me, yeah. But as a person and a brother and a family member, helping change some of your siblings' lives. I don't know if I'll ever get close to that. That was a pretty cool moment.
Yeah. Wow, mate. Unbelievable. And obviously you get a great deal with it as well, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, like, I did obviously a great deal for myself, but I was in a fortunate position anyway. Like I had a real good business anyway. And, you know, we've been doing some great deals with the stuff that we're doing. And I knew Ben Eubank was always on the cards. So I knew that I was always going to be okay, like no matter what. But then that came around and really flipped it for me.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, I'm now earning serious amounts of money in a real short period of time. And again, going back to, I need to make some big decisions on how I'm going to actually manage this and how I'm going to perform at this sort of level. That was when you need to start bringing in your team.
Amazing.
And also I want to mention this because Barry Earn's been a big mentor to me and I don't really speak about it a lot and neither does he. So, but he spent a lot of time with me, hours and hours of time just going through different things, and I get to ask him, somebody so experienced, someone who's worth, you know, serious amounts of money, questions about. Because look, we all have ideas of like, when I make this amount of money, I'm going to do this with it, I'm going to do that with it. Well, I don't care who you are, when it actually happens to you, you then have to, you know, shit gets real. And you do have to start making them decisions, and they're not as easy to make as they once were when you didn't have the money. Now you got the money. Now you need to do something with it. So I needed some real advice and I needed to be mentored. And I want to shout out to Barry, who's been amazing.
What a great mentor to have, man. It's what people say as well, don't they? Like, more money just makes you more of who you already are. So unless you've got the awareness to figure that shit out before you get it. Man, I'm so pleased for you, genuinely. Like, it's really inspiring sitting across from you and hearing about the heights that you can reach. You know, it's all come from the hard work, but it's really great to see that. And I think some people might be jealous or be envious of some people's success. But, you know, I think if we can, more of us can be inspired by what other people are doing. I think it's incredible what you're doing. So congrats again, mate.
Cheers, man. Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for coming to my house.
No, me too, mate. It's been a pleasure. Hey, it's Mark Whittle. Thanks so much for watching or listening. It's so great to have you a part of the Take Flight movement. Subscribe to the podcast on all platforms, video and audio, to be the first to see new episodes and new conversations with the greatest minds in the world. Follow me at MarkWhittle_TF on all social platforms and visit takeflightworld.com to join our growing community of hustlers, performers and go-getters. I can't wait to see you next time. Until then, stay positive, stay motivated, and of course, take flight.